morning. This being the last full day of our Angul retreat period, as well as this session, I can feel the energies kind of moving this way and moving that way. Tomorrow we have a marvelous Dharma celebration, and many of the Sangha from New York and different places will come. And we'll hear from our Shuso, and he'll offer us teachings, and we'll offer him teachings. It should be a lovely day. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. We've been talking about this all during the Angho in different kinds of ways, and it's a very subtle thing, this relationship between how we see reality. Samsara, nirvana. Samsara, nirvana. What do we mean by that? This very place is the lotus land, he says. This very body, the Buddha. But it's so easy to think that it's a thing, a solid thing that one becomes and then doesn't ever move back into ice. It's so easy to think that, and it's so easy to become disillusioned with a form of practice or a teacher or a sangha, simply because they are not in the very moment that you happen to be awake. They're not. It is a really important thing to realize. This is elusive. Many of you have gone very deep in this session and tasted a real stillness. I like to think of it as a glimpse of ourself without any of the extra stuff that we put on top, we disguise ourselves with. And of course, many of us have been also on the dark path. What does he say? Lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds also. And that can lead us to a kind of self-punishment or unskillful thinking, unskillful acting. And yet there's clarity even there, if we're aware and allow direct awareness. Bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. When we feel that way, you know, it's like everything is fresh and new. The beautiful sound of the cicadas. A kind of sense of joy and optimism, possibility. That practice will play a part in our life. That the Sangha and our relationships with it can help us to manifest compassion and wisdom. And I think a lot of us will feel that way tomorrow. It's often kind of the rush after session, kind of high. Some people get addicted to. In one of his writings, I discovered of Hakuin's that I hadn't read before. It's in a collection about Kensho that Thomas Cleary translated. So he has a little of Chenol, he's with different writers, and writing of Hakuin's where he talks about this mythological Buddhist story, which seems to come from some Hindu myths, but is also present in the Rinzai Roku. And it's about a great battle between the gods And the Asuras, or the Titans, is often translated as Titans, you know, because Asuras are these kind of these warlike beings, violent, very violent beings, super beings. You know, they're kind of like above us. They're gods and they're super beings. And of course, when I say that, what I'm referring to is that in the moment that we are a human, and then there's the moment that we are a titan, and then there is the moment that we are a god. And of all the those moments, to be a human is you have the greatest possibility of becoming awake. There's also hungry ghosts and animals. But if you're human, you have a possibility. You know, the gods, things are too easy for them. And the Asuras are very angry beings. So, anyway, this is the story of a battle between the gods and the Asuras, or the gods and the Titans. And the Titans, all 84,000 of them, so don't think there's just one or two, all 84,000 of them lose the battle, and they're fleeing from the gods. And what they do is they escape by hiding in the fibers of a lotus stem. By hiding in the threads of a lotus stem. And Hakuin questions, what does this mean? He says, he wonders why the fierce titans who could hide anywhere would want to choose the fibers. If you've ever, you know, looked at a lotus stem, you know, if you've ever seen them, they're very fibrous. Why would they hide there? And he writes, I wondered why a titan with such miraculous powers would particularly seek out a lotus thread hole to hide when defeated in battle, whereas it could freely hide anywhere, in the eye of a moth, in the nostril of a mosquito, in an atom, on the tip of a needle. And even if the titans manage to hide, the perception of the gods takes in the whole universe, like a crystal in the palm of the hand. How could anything be overlooked? That's very interesting. He reinterprets the story in a way that's very helpful for those of us who meditate and practice Zen. He says that, you know, suppose we're sitting in silent, quiet meditation, empty and clear, and suddenly we're beset with the violent and angry streams of thought. Confusion, frustration. He writes about it so beautifully, I'm going to quote him. Suddenly, feelings and thoughts start arising in confusion, like clouds and fog enfolding the whole sky, like gigantic waves swallowing huge mountains. Valleys roar, mountains snort. Odoriferous mist spews hailstones. Toxic fog encages lightning and thunder. I don't think there's anyone in this room who hasn't experienced such a moment on the cushion. So different from our idealization of what meditation is. And we also experience this at other times in our life. Usually, we're so caught up in it that we don't observe it. We don't know that that's what's happening to us. We're walking down the street. A thought about something that happened before occurs to us. And we begin to make a little story about it. A story that actually is a story. It doesn't have any kind of relationship to reality. This is what that person meant by that. And this is what's going to happen. And we attribute motivation. We attribute action. And we have no idea. We make this whole thing up. But we're caught up in it. We're like, there's no observer seeing what we're doing. It happens in our life. And why we practice, one of the skills of meditation practice is that we can, when we're sitting still, begin to see, to directly experience, to become aware of what our mind is doing. Hakuin says that when we're so caught up like that, it's when the Titan is winning the battle against the gods. And the Titans manifest a giant body so enormous that it makes the ocean seem shallow and the sky seem narrow. You know, when the Titan of my mind is triumphant, everything is narrow and small. The sky cannot be seen. It's as if we have blinders. When the Titan takes over, there's no place for a fish to swim or a bird to fly. There's just anger, doubt, and fear. So then he says, at this point, if you suddenly wake up and bring to mind the saying you've been contemplating, or else turn to what is inherent in yourself, it is like pouring a dipperful of cool water into a pot of boiling water. The ocean of essential nature becomes calm. The mind source becomes open and aware. This is the time when the king of the gods prevails in the battle. This is when we've been sitting and it's narrow and dark, and suddenly we take a breath and we adjust our posture and we come back. We learn to pour cool water on our raging thoughts. Or, you know, if we're lucky, it's also when we're in the midst of a discussion that has gotten out of hand with someone we're related to, either at home or at work or in the Sangha, and we suddenly see that we're caught in a dream, in a fantasy. It isn't what is really happening. We learn to pour cool water on that raging storm. The practice is to learn to not, to be able to pull back from the seduction that the Titans bring. Our thirst for me, 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 something else, something that will satisfy our internally hungry mouths, the rage of feeling not appreciated, not understood, or the ignorant Titan who thinks they are the only one in the universe. Hakuin describes this experience of the arrival of the gods. The web of the cosmos has infinite dimensions, each reflecting everything with infinite centers and peripheries. So it's that letting go of that focus on self and seeing the interconnection. It's like a cool breeze. We're back in the present moment. And he says, you jump for joy, thinking everything is settled. And here's what I love most about his story, what I find most intriguing. He says, what you do not realize is that the demons have gone into these subtle thoughts of joy and are hiding there, completely intact. You Yeah, huh? Hiding there in the threads of the lotus. Truly a practice of a lifetime. This image really haunts me. It's subtle. Ice and water. In the midst of our joy and our compassion and our love and our generosity, within all these marvelous qualities that we have, within our awakening, also there lurking are those titans. In the very fiber of our enlightenment is that self-clinging. We don't want to hear this. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just do a sesshin and then be perfect? Or find the perfect spiritual tradition that would make everything fine. But that is not the profound teaching of the lotus. We talk about the lotus a lot. Growing in murky, stinking ponds. With its feet in the mud. Symbolizing what is impure, what is unclean, and also the rich medium of growth. As Maizumi Roshi always used to say, fish can't survive in water that's too pure. The lotus absorbs these energies and transforms them. So, receives its nourishment from this murky, dense mud. And it grows above the water to bloom. Sometimes, you know, the lotuses, if you've seen them, you know, they grow like 8 or 10 inches above the water. They're marvelous to look at. And they're just pristine. They look so beautiful, so perfectly clean and pure. And so they came to represent in Buddhist iconography, our best nature. Our most skillful thought, our most best way of being in the world. And when we bloom, we are beautiful, like a lotus, and brilliant and clean and clear. And within every stem that is holding us up, above that water, are those titans of greed, anger, and ignorance. We would not be held up if it weren't for those titans of greed, anger, and ignorance. Hakuin says, we can transform those energies. We can continually work to transform these energies. Of course, he was very fond of koan practice, and so he said, by gnawing or chewing on them vertically and horizontally, by chewing on the koan mu, which is no, nothing. It is also not this and not that. We can use the breath in the same way. Don't need a koan to chew vertically and horizontally on the stem. Vertically, we chew through the demons that are within us. We meet them, recognize them, feed them lotus flowers. Feed your anger, lotus flowers. Feed your greed, lotus flowers. By meeting yourself top to bottom in each instant, by your direct awareness, your direct observation, you can transform these demons. And horizontally, I think we chew through the demons that are around us, the demons of our collective karma, and those we encounter, the whole world. There's no demon left out. For example, there's a woman's name whom we chant when we chant the matriarch's lineage, Ohashi Daiosho. Sally Teasdale, who's a Zen student and writer, has recorded stories of many of these women in her book, Women of the Way. And in fact, the particular matriarchal lineage that we chant was put together by Sally Teasdale for the various different Zen schools here. And she tells the story about Ohashi. I looked it up because I wondered, and I was right, that sure enough, there was a matriarch that had met Hakuin. She was a young Japanese girl living in the neighborhood where Hakuin lived, on that post road near Shoenji. And she came from a very, very poor family. Her father had been a samurai, and that was at that time when all the samurais became unemployed, and he became alcoholic, and she was the eldest daughter in this very poor family, needed money, and she did what many young girls do, and at the age of 14 became a prostitute, a sex worker, to help support her family. She hated her work, and she found it boring, and she found the people she encountered boorish. And she was pretty much angry most of the time. And yet, she saw no way out of the situation. She didn't want to work in the fields or in the silk factory. And she was very unhappy. So, cranky Ohashi. And she saw Hakuin, who frequented the tavern where she worked. And she was very affected by his presence, the way he held himself and spoke. And she would kind of hang around to hear what he had to say to the other monks in the tavern. I may be adding a little bit to this story, I have to confess, but I know I'm right. So she did, after a long time, get up the nerve to talk to him and told him how much she hated her life and wanted something else. And he told her to go off and chant the Imejiku Kanongyo, which we chant every day, which would give her faith. And she did this for quite some time and eventually came back to him and said, I want to study Zen. But she said, I can't, because it's not possible given the work that I do. And he told her not to use it, her daily life, as an excuse not to practice, but to practice in the midst of her life. And this is the way Sally Teasdale imagines that he spoke to her. Dear, you can find stillness anywhere, and it's best to find it in noise and action. Then it's real. Then you know it utterly. Koans and sitting meditation are meaningless without work. So just do your work. Eventually, you will just do what you are doing and not know the difference between meditation and anything else. And it said that at hearing this, she completely changed her way of being. And people noticed her, noticed the way she was. She was no longer angry and bored. And people came to her, started coming to her for advice. And eventually there was a wealthy man who was a student of Hakuin's who bought her freedom. And she had a great awakening experience during a thunderstorm one night. And Hakuin wrote a verse and verified her Satori. One story says she married, and another story says, no, she became a nun. But she is remembered because of the nature of her karma. As a prostitute, whom Hakuin himself encouraged to practice in the midst of her work. To practice in the midst of your work. Over and over and over again we say samsara and nirvana are not two. To practice in the midst of such work is chewing on our demons. To not push away our anger and our frustration. To sit with them and to transform them. It's hard to see how to do that. It's hard to do it. It's hard to realize that. But if we allow the lotus to blossom, if we see our true nature, if we can show it, we can encounter what we really are. Entwined in the threads is enlightenment and delusion. They're never separate. There's always the subtle traces. And there is compassion, there is service, there is vow, the intention to serve all beings. If we can take that further step and recognize that self-clinging is present in our every act, and yet go ahead and act. Go ahead and help people to cross over. Then we're truly humble and liberated from the idea of life, death, good, bad, self, other. Bright, the full moon of wisdom. Is anything missing? Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. Can you kensho that?
Don't you mean?